Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Memorial Day was the unofficial start of summer here in the United States, yet summer and pandemic are two realities that seem to be headed for a collision. Massive pool parties in places, crowded beaches in others. So what happens when people are playing by different rules? Some states are opening up quickly, others slowly. Science journalist Ed Yong calls it a patchwork pandemic. We'll ask him why and what to do about it. And Ed Yong joins us today from Washington, D.C. He covers science for The Atlantic, and he's been writing about the coronavirus day in and day out for the last many months. And his latest piece is America's Patchwork Pandemic is Fraying Even Further. Ed, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is your definition of a patchwork pandemic?
So it's this idea that there's a huge amount of variety in how America is experiencing the pandemic from one state to the other, from one county to the next. In some places that were particularly badly hit initially by this virus, things seem to be under control. So cases are declining in places like New York, but they are still rising in other parts of the country that perhaps didn't really experience the worst of the pandemic initially. And if you average these trends out, what you see is the national pattern, which is a plateau that existed for much of April, and now this slight, gentle downward slope. But that overall pattern masks a lot of difference around the country. And those differences, I think, will make it much harder to understand what is happening with the pandemic, to predict what is likely to happen in the future, and to get the entire crisis under control. It's not just one crisis. There are a lot of interconnected ones.
Right. So can we just talk about that plateau and the slight downward curve for
sure.
A little bit more, Ed, because as you write, it's the shape of the curve right now in the United States is not a Matterhorn. That's the phrase,
right.
The analogy used, which I thought was very nice. It's not sharply up and then sharply down.
It is
that sort of plateau, that little mesa, and a small reduction internally. Does this mean that we may not see a dramatic reduction in the daily number of new cases by the time, say, perhaps a second wave hits?
At a national level, sure, that's totally a possibility. And again, I think it is hard to predict, but this mental model that a lot of us have had where there's a first wave, there's that sharp peak, a descent, you know, kind of like how a child might draw a mountain, and then you get a lull over the summer, and then maybe a second peak later. I don't think that is necessarily going to happen. We don't really know what is going to happen because of this patchwork effect, because the virus that initially hit coastal cities is now moving into rural areas, into suburbs, because you'll get outbreaks happening in hotspots all around the country, because next month's hotspots are going to be different to the previous months. All of these effects mean that this idea of distinct national peaks separated by lulls of maybe safety and security might never happen. And I think we need to hold ourselves, society and our national leadership accountable for that. Like this pattern need not have happened, and it exists because, you know, partly because America is so big and so diverse, but also because the country's response to this pandemic has been so fractured and fragmented.
Right. I mean, you quote epidemiologist Caitlin Rivers as saying the talk of a second wave, as if we've exited the first, doesn't capture what's really happening, right? It's more like the wave is just sort of moving around the country.
Right. Yeah. In an earlier piece, I described what happens next as this very lengthy, protracted whack-a-mole game with the virus as it pops up from place to place, and we have to keep on battering it down. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing now. And that pattern, that whack-a-mole pattern, it doesn't easily lend itself to those distinct peaks and troughs that I think a lot of us have sort of come to mentally expect.
Now, in this latest article that you wrote for The Atlantic, you break down the consequences of this patchwork in sort of many different realms. And I'd love to explore some of them further with you.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, there's the sheer sort of physical health consequences, which we'll get to. But you start by actually pointing out the psychological consequences of having a patchwork pandemic. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so... As at the start of this, I think large proportions of the country were united in this shared experience. I think very quickly people began to realize that this was bad, that a lot of stay-at-home orders were rolled out in quick succession. A lot of people were quarantining themselves, isolating at home, and that created this kind of communal, collective experience of the pandemic. But that, you know, that was obviously not rolled out completely equally at the start, and that disparity is increasing as some states have opened up early. Others are still under some form of restriction. And we're now seeing those dynamics play out over this weekend where, for example, I've been still at home all weekend and I've been looking at videos of people on pool parties and beaches, like crowding back into restaurants. And I think that increasing dissociation of experience is going to lead to people having very different and fragmented perceptions of what the pandemic is actually doing. So, you know, for people still staying at home, are they going to be confused by scenes of people partying outdoors? Are they going to judge those people? Are they going to feel like they're being hard done by being made to stay at home? And how are those dynamics going to shape people's willingness to partake of the public health measures that we know are effective in keeping this pandemic under control?
Right. So are they going to be confused? Will they be feeling that they're being hard done by, et cetera? I think the answer is yes, yes, and yes to all of those questions, right?
Right. So I think it could play out in one of two different ways, right? So on the one hand, it's very easy to see how that fraying of our collective experience is going to lead people to do slightly risky things. Like, I'm sitting at home. I don't get any like pleasant, rewarding dopamine kick from my actions. You know, my health might be better, but I don't feel like viscerally good about it. Whereas if you go outside, you get to hug your friends, you get to experience the sun, you get to sort of experience a sense of normalcy that has been denied to you. So it's very easy to think that people in the former group will be more tempted to do what the latter group is doing. And that's going to be exacerbated by everything we've seen in media reports this weekend, this disparity in spectacle where the people who are behaving most incautiously are the most visible, the most telegenic, and they are going to dominate coverage of the pandemic for the near future. That being said, you could also see a different thing happening where actually people's, if you look at national polls, if you look at studies of people's attitudes and behaviors, there's a surprising amount of unity in the American experience of this pandemic. A lot of people are still cautious about reopening. They still think that social distancing is important. They are generally supportive of wearing masks. Large studies have suggested that like upwards of 70-75% of people are behaving and thinking along these ways. And that's almost unheard of in like American opinion polling. So I think there's a lot of this coverage, a lot of this spectacle that is masking a surprising amount of unity and cohesion among public attitudes that might see more collective action than one might expect. expect given these disparate experiences.
You know, so Ed, this makes me think that what we really should be talking about on this show, maybe at a future date, is a rigorous self-analysis about the media's role here. Because as you point out, if what's being covered nationally through regular media and especially social media diverges from people's local lived experience, that divergence is what sort of creates the gap where more misinformation or justification for bad behavior or a loss of a sense that we're all in it together, that's where it all rushes in.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, the news is the news, right? The clue's in the name. We want to report on stuff that is new, that is different. And especially when it comes to, you know, visual formats, you want stuff that actually looks interesting. But that means that there is a huge incentive for covering what might be fringe behavior, people flocking into public spaces, like armed anti-lockdown protests. All of these make for much more compelling news than scenes of people sheltering responsibly at home. You know, no one's going to be filming me in my living room, you know, self-isolating, whereas they're absolutely going to cover people on a crowded beach. And I understand that, but I also think that it creates this perhaps distorted view of whether America is taking the pandemic seriously, and it risks normalizing actually rare behavior in a way that would encourage people who are behaving responsibly to do something different. And I do worry about that. I worry that our instincts in the news media are not sufficiently geared towards covering a crisis that is very persistent and that is very patchworked, like the one that we're currently facing.
Well, we are talking this hour with Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic. He's written exclusively about the novel coronavirus pandemic for the past several months, has been writing about microbes for years, in fact. He's author of the 2016 book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. So we want to know what your question is for Ed about this pandemic, about this particular virus. Send us a tweet at On Point Radio or on Facebook at On Point Radio as well. And yes, I know I just slammed social media for being an area of disinformation or misinformation, but let's carve out this corner for smart questions and smart answers as well. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with science journalist Ed Yong. He's the science writer for The Atlantic. He's written hundreds of absolutely fascinating articles over the past many years. Of course, recently, he's been focused exclusively on the COVID-19 pandemic. His latest piece is America's Patchwork Pandemic is Fraying Even Further. And we have a link to that and Ed's other work at onpointradio.org. Ed, I wanted to pick up where we left off in the previous segment about how the information that people are receiving in this patchwork pandemic is critical to influencing their behavior, because you were talking about how the risks of sort of normalizing the outliers in terms of behavior, and that produces a kind of ambiguity that's hard for people to navigate. And isn't that ambiguity already made even worse by the fact that when it comes to actual data about this pandemic, we simply don't have enough?
Yes. So I touched on this in an earlier piece about why the coronavirus is so confusing. But just by virtue of its newness, the fact that this virus, no one knew about it until several months ago, and we're all scrambling now to learn more about it at a time when the world is undergoing a huge amount of upheaval. So, you know, the science is progressing. I feel like we've learned a lot about it in just the last few months. But I think the pace at which that knowledge is accumulating is slow compared to what we want. You know, we are stuck in this place of incredible uncertainty and high fear and anxiety, and we want to know more. So, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one listening to this who constantly scrolls their social media feeds looking for more information. And I think sometimes that instinct works against us because new information isn't actually available at the speed we want it to be. And our continual quest for more of it leaves us open to misinformation, to people who claim expertise, who make very loud statements that aren't necessarily true, but that get amplified by the networks that we tap into in our desire to know more.
Right.
And, you know, I think sometimes I wonder if we should all just be trying to slow down a bit in our consumption of news and about stuff about the pandemic.
Yes, I'm nodding my head vigorously, yes, because I think that one of the major problems now, obviously not just regarding this pandemic, but in life in general, but it is underscored in the COVID-19 pandemic, is we are living in a world that's so information saturated that I think we have become used to sort of an instant gratification of knowledge, right? We just presume, like, if we can type it on a keyboard and look it up, we will find the answer. And we haven't been presented nationwide in a long time with a situation where we simply don't know, and we have to come to terms with the fact that the act of building that knowledge can be plodding and slow and deliberate, and that it takes time.
That's so true, and and I think a point that isn't discussed enough, that we're kind of informationally spoiled. You know, we really do expect to have information at our fingertips. I have, you know, entire encyclopedias on this little box and on my, that also doubles as my phone and now my recording studio. You know, I can get real-time information on where every plane in the air is in the world. I can look at who is reading my pieces in real time. But I can't get real-time information about the pandemic. And that is weird and frustrating for, you know, 2020. And the information that we can get is deeply flawed. So just take, you know, numbers of cases. Those numbers, it's very easy to think of them as being a real-time view of the spread of the infection, but they're not. They reflect the amount of testing that's been done, the accuracy of those tests, and all kinds of other factors. The same goes for death rates, for many of the other statistics that go around this pandemic. And I think that we need to take a step back and appreciate that a woman named Natalie Dean, who's a statistician at the University of Florida, she mentioned to me that it's really hard to measure stuff. Like people who work in public health understand this, but, like, you know, I think she said to me that 80% of the problem is in measuring things. And so when we look at numbers about the pandemic, we need to appreciate that they aren't the kind of real-time information that we're used to getting, and that they reflect as much the tools that we're trying to use and the flaws in those tools as the actual reality that's trying to be measured.
Right. I think this is one of the great long-term lessons of this pandemic, is that we have to collectively learn once again how to live with uncertainty. I mean, we are bathed in real-time data, real-time information as a whole, but to make sense of that data and information takes time. And I think that that gap is what we're going to have to learn. What does it mean to live with that constant gap between the flow of data and actual meaningful understanding? Now, of course, in the case of the pandemic, Ed, as you well know, this problem has been made infinitely worse by the lack, in the United States specifically, by the lack of testing, the variability of testing, the variability of the accuracy of the testing, as you mentioned. So even that initial flow of data has been problematic from the start.
Yes, and I think that this has been a problem that has really cost the US over the last several months. Our inability to roll out an accurate, widespread test for the virus hampered the response in the early months of February and March. And it is still a problem to date. In many places, testing is nowhere near the level that it needs to be to successfully control the virus. Let's admit that, yes, it has improved, and it has improved in some places more than others, but there are still ongoing problems. The fact that the CDC numbers do not, in many cases, match up to what states are reporting. The fact that many states are combining the results from both a diagnostic test for the virus, so whether you are actually infected now, with antibody tests, which tell you whether you have been infected at some point in the past, in a way that a lot of public health experts, I think, would agree is just absurd, contributes to our ongoing failure to really map out where the virus is, what exactly it's doing, and therefore what control measures we need to put in place. And this failure, it has been, I think, one of the things that has truly surprised even the people who have long warned that a pandemic was a real risk and that the nation was not prepared enough. This is one way in which we have proven to be unprepared that I think people were not expecting, and that continues to be a significant blow to our ability to bring COVID-19 under control.
Ed, is it possible that for as long as we don't have enough people getting tested accurately, or even a statistically significant number of people getting tested, that we may not know how prevalent the infection actually is in this country, or truly how many people have died? I mean, is it possible that we just won't know that?
So I think that it's likely that our official numbers are going to be severe underestimates of the true burden of COVID-19 in this country, for many reasons, including the fact that testing is still underwhelming. Death stats also are very difficult to do. Like, again, this goes back to what we were talking about how our expectation that we get solid real-time numbers on these things is wrong. It's actually very hard to understand death tolls from a crisis like this. We don't have to be this bad at it. You know, we can roll out testing to the degree we need. We have other solutions that will help us get a sense of what the virus is doing. But to do that, we need some kind of national coordinated strategy. Tests do need to be coordinated across the country, so they're delivered to places that need them the most rather than places that just happen to get their act in gear because of local leadership. And this is a thing that I talk about in my piece about the patchwork pandemic. There was always going to be a patchwork. It did not need to be as intense or as frayed as it currently is. And one of the reasons why it is that way is because the federal government has largely abdicated its responsibility in coordinating the rollout of things like tests and medical supplies and just political action among the different states. It is meant to provide consistency, financial support, and coordination of supply chains. It has not done these things. And as a result, states are just doing their own thing, and the collective whole of America's response is far less than the sum of its parts.
So, Ed, can I just jump in here for a second? Because let's be clear, yeah, about, let's be clear about this, because this is really important. You write specifically that given the state-federal system in this country, there was always going to be something of a patchwork, as you're saying. And in fact, regarding public health, that's not entirely a bad thing, right? Because local public right. health officials know their localities better than anybody in Washington. So describe to me, though, ideally, in more detail, what would be the ideal role of the federal government to support or coordinate state and local efforts?
Right. So the super simple way of describing it is that the federal government's responsibility is to set up the conditions under which the states can win. So it has very deep pockets. It can fund the kind of massive rollout of testing, contact tracing efforts that we need to bring the pandemic under control. It can coordinate. So it can procure supplies, tests, and medical protective equipment at the scale where you can start getting economies of scale, and then it can roll out those equipments, those supplies to places that need them most, rather than places that just have deep pockets or places where leaders got their acting gear at the start. It can also provide consistency of messaging. So sure, you want one state to be able to reopen when it's appropriate, and another state to keep on keep a lockdown going when that's appropriate. But those states should all be working under the same consistent framework, regardless of whether they're doing different things. That's important for public trust and communication. It's also important for providing legal cover for the state, so that if they are challenged, they can say that actually we were following this consistent framework. So there's a lot the federal government should be able to do. This idea of American federalism isn't that the federal government just absolves itself of responsibility and the states just do what they like. The tiers are meant to support each other. And if the top one isn't doing that, the bottom ones just start fraying into something a bit more chaotic. And that's what we're seeing now, where governors are having to bid against each other, against other countries, in some cases, even against the federal government. Mm. And that is not federalism working as intended. That is, that is a ship with 50 rudders and a captain that is either asleep or just absolving itself of responsibility.
Well, we're talking this hour with Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic, has written exclusively about COVID-19 for the past several months, has long had an interest in the microbial world as well. Ed, I want to play an interview or a moment from an interview that you gave to C-SPAN in June of 2018, so almost 2 years ago now. And you were asked then in 2018 if the U.S. was ready for the next pandemic. And here's what you said.
The U.S. has many strengths. It has a great research arm. It's got the CDC, one of the world's greatest public health agencies. But it is also disturbingly vulnerable in many ways. And I think recent brushes with epidemics and pandemics have shown that. In the last major pandemic in 2009, which was a strain of H1N1 swine flu, the U.S. was caught unprepared. Its surveillance network was looking in the wrong part of the world. Its ability to make vaccines was too slow, so vaccines only rolled out after the pandemic had peaked, and hospitals were stretched pretty thin, as is often the case with our very decentralized healthcare system. So there were many, many vulnerabilities that could be easily exploited by a much deadlier pathogen.
That's Ed Yong on C-SPAN in 2018. And also in 2018, Ed wrote a piece for The Atlantic titled "The Next Plague Is Coming, Is America Ready?" Now, Ed, I noted in that cut that we played, some of the things that you pointed out about America's vulnerability were sort of technocratic things, right? The surveillance, disease surveillance looking in the wrong places, vaccine production maybe not being up to par, of course, the healthcare system. You didn't point out politics or the potential for political failures. Did you see that on the horizon in 2018?
So 2018 now feels like 150 years ago.
At least.
At least, yes. In the before times, I did write in the piece that you mentioned about whether America is prepared about the possible for the possibility for political failures. I also wrote a piece in late 2015 about what would happen if a Trump administration would face a pandemic of this kind. So I think it has been clear to me and to others that that politics was always going to be a part of this. And I don't think I quite anticipated how bad it would be. I don't think I anticipated a federal government that really would be so passive in the face of this. You know, I wrote in that 2018 piece that I think Trump's predilection for misinformation, his tendency to buy into conspiracy theories, his instinct not to unify a nation and to provide clear communication, but instead to create wedges and to define others, was going to work out badly for a country in the case of a crisis like this. And I think we've seen all those instincts at play, but just more so. And I think that is part of the underlying problem here. One of the reasons why the response is so patchworked.
Well, we are talking this hour with Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic. He has written extensively about pandemics, not just this one that we're experiencing now, but as we're noting, back in 2018, he asked the question, will America be ready for the next plague? We've got a link to all of Ed's work, or a lot of Ed's work, at onpointradio.org, and we'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to take a look at inspectors general in the United States, in the U.S. federal government specifically. The president has recently fired a number of inspectors general, so we're going to take a look at why and the impact that that is having on accountability and even on democracy in the United States. So if you have a question about the roles of inspectors general in the federal government and the impact of the frequent firing of them, call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Leave us your story or your question in a voicemail at that number, and we might use it tomorrow in the program. Today, we are talking with Ed Yong. He is a celebrated science writer for The Atlantic, has written extensively about plagues and pandemics. He's author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. That's his 2016 book. He's most recently author of a piece in The Atlantic called America's Patchwork Pandemic is Fraying Even Further. Now, Ed, I just want to take a quick step back here. What first got you interested in diving much deeper into understanding the possibility of a future pandemic?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it was there was a point in 2018 when I realized that I'd been writing about this sort of off and on a little bit before, and it struck me that I'd written about this concept of preparedness for a while, but didn't really have a firm grasp on what that meant. It felt a bit abstract. Like, what does it actually mean to be prepared for a pandemic? And I wanted to find out. So that was the basis of the piece I wrote in 2018. So looking at everything from vaccines to surveillance, but also things that I don't think I properly wrestled with, like political will, like what I described as the cycle of panic and neglect, this inability to learn from past crises and to properly gird ourselves from future ones, and that sort of playing out in this current pandemic now.
So that's for regarding your interest in pandemics. And how about microbes in general?
I think there's something truly fascinating about things that we cannot see and that have no tangible experience of, that yet deeply influence the world around us. So in the book, I'm writing about microbes that very positively influence our lives, our bodies, our health, and those of other animals around us, about this growing awareness that microbes are a deep and profound part of our own biology, and we can't understand ourselves without understanding them. Obviously, the events of the world around us now show a clear example of how the opposite effect is important too, about how microbes can really bring the entire world to heal very quickly. Right. This new virus is just nothing. It's like this little scrap of genes encased in a tiny, tiny shell, and yet it is sufficient to really reshape the entire modern world. And I think there's something very, it should cause us to be newly humble.
Well, I've always thought that, to your point, though they are invisible, the microbial world is the thing that will forever remind us that we are of nature, not apart from it, no matter how hard we try. Now, listen, Ed, we've got a lot of questions coming in for you from our listeners online, and Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, has hopped into the studio to share some of those questions. So what have you got, Dori?
One person on Twitter asked if there's historical evidence of similar rebellious or nihilistic behavior among people during past pandemics. Or they ask, is what we're witnessing, people on beaches and in restaurants at this time, is this a new phenomenon in the U.S.?
Oh, that is such a good question. My feeling is that yes, nothing in terms of people's behavior now in this pandemic is new. A lot of it reflects long-standing aspects of human nature. I do think that if we want to get a better answer to this, we should probably talk to many of the excellent medical historians whom I know. I feel a bit underqualified to talk about it. I will say that my sense of the behavior that we're seeing reflects not only where we are in terms of time, but also in geography. I've written before about how a lot of aspects of American character in particular, and especially in this in the last few decades, is influencing what we're seeing now. This idea that a lot of America has internalized in the years after 9/11 of being unafraid, of being brave in the face of terror, is sort of playing out in some of the rhetoric we're seeing people like not wanting to live in fear. But unfortunately, we're not dealing with terror. We're dealing with a virus that has no concern for how scared you are. It just wants to infect your cells. And I think that instinct that has really been enshrined over the last couple of decades is leading to behavior that is not productive.
Yeah, this next question from Dan on Twitter. He teaches a course on science communication, and he actually uses your work in class to give students examples of great science writing. So he asked, what advice would you give young science writers, science advocates, and students in general when they're having a tough time communicating, you know, complex scientific ideas, especially when it's so important for the public to get that information clearly?
Oh, okay. More great questions. I think that one thing I've recognized in this pandemic is that the basic unit of science writing is often just the study. So we have this pattern of writing about a particular paper that's come out. And I kind of feel that that instinct is serving us ill in this pandemic. I think this idea that we're just writing about one particular study, when in fact this crisis is huge and extends across different fields, is not the right thing. I've tried in a lot of my reporting to write big sweeping pieces that, instead of focusing on just one particular aspect, look at a large number of different things, that talk to people from different disciplines, not just virologists and epidemiologists, but also social scientists, historians, anthropologists, sociologists. And I think that that to me is where so that's helping me get a much better understanding of the pandemic, rather than just focusing on this one team of researchers wrote this one paper where they're finding this one particular thing. I think like going bigger and going broader is certainly helping me, and I'm hoping that helps others. I hope that it helps my readers too.
So Ed, point taken, you're doing the work of crafting meaning or the bigger picture out of those individual units of scientific information. But this, I hate to drag it back to where we were about 20 minutes ago in this conversation, but I have to. Do you sometimes feel as if you're shouting into the void given the onslaught of other units of information, or should I call it misinformation, that people are constantly bombarded with?
Yes, I do. And it is, it can be demoralizing. It is not easy. But I do think that the work is necessary, and I do think it helps. You know, I've had really lovely emails and messages from readers who've said that the work helps them just root themselves to gain some measure of understanding amidst all this tumultuous stream of information and misinformation. A colleague of mine noted that if we are resigned to only learning from hindsight, then someone does still have to provide that hindsight. Mm. And I think I want to write pieces that will hopefully stand the test of time and that will act as a sort of historical marker for where we are, despite the fact that things seem like they're changing so quickly all the time.
Yeah.
I think the work is... It's important, but it's paradoxical to me because it has never felt so important, but also so inadequate to the task. It's just a drop in the ocean, but I think it still matters.
It very much matters. Oh, without a doubt, I would say it matters hugely because it is a drop in a large ocean. But every drop counts. In fact, I would take it further, Ed, and say that, to the point of the listener who Dory read that listener's question, I would also love to see your articles become required reading in middle school or high school science classes, to be perfectly honest, because the sooner and earlier that this big picture of these important moments in science become part of the regular learning and conversation of people, I think the better off we all are. Being on that soapbox for a moment. But Dory's got at least one more question here from from our listeners.
Yeah, Paul on Facebook had a question that fits into all of this about experts and the role of experts in this moment. He wants to know if you have any additional thoughts on how well the media does at vetting scientific experts, and whether we, in this moment, in that dire search for information, it's leading to trusting maybe too many unqualified opinions about what to do in this pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of people are being given airtime, for being very loud and outspoken, and instead of actually genuinely having expertise. Now, you know, I fully recognize the irony of being interviewed for an hour on a radio show, being a journalist and not a specific expert in this field. But what I've tried to do is to synthesize a wide range of expertise in the work that I do. And I think that's important. So the nature of a modern academia is that expertise tends to be incredibly deep, but very narrow. Mm-hmm. And I think when you deal with a problem as broad as this pandemic, you need to recognize that and to bring in experts from lots of different fields. So you need to recognize that you can't just like talk to one virologist and expect them to know everything, or even worse, just talk to someone like a Nobel laureate and expect their credentials to make them an expert on everything. You need to talk to epidemiologists, sociologists, or all the people who I've described before, and integrate a lot across all of their different bounds of knowledge. And I think that I feel like I've traditionally not done the best job of that. I think that I'm trying to do that now. And I think that all of us could do that better. We need to be very wary of what expertise people actually have, not dismiss people who aren't like specialists in specific areas, but try and work out what they are actually bringing to the field. And finally, I really do think that a lot of journalists could do a much better job of interviewing more women, more people of color, people whose voices are traditionally have not been featured enough in media in general, and in media about the pandemic specifically.
Well, Ed, we've got about three-ish minutes here left, and I want to explore with you the last concept that you leave us with in your article about the patchwork pandemic. And if I may, I'm just going to read the last graph here, because you write, of all the threats we know, the COVID-19 pandemic is most like a very rapid version of climate change, global in its scope, erratic in its unfolding, and unequal in its distribution. And like climate change, there is no easy fix. Our choices are to remake society or let it be remade, to smooth the patchworks old and new, or let them fray even further. Now, one of our listeners read, well, many of them, but it's one of them read your article and sent us this voicemail question as well. So this is Melissa from Bridgewater, Massachusetts.
Articles like these, Mr. Young, strike me as horrifically true. How do we cope with these truths, historical, social, and political, and still find strength to move forward? I read your descriptions of the future. The nation will further fracture or it will heal. And I see the former, the fracturing, most likely. How do you, or how do we, live, raise our kids, hope, stay politically engaged when so much seems so dire? I'm curious what is helping you cope with the facts these days. What gives you tragic optimism? And there I quote Viktor Frankl.
So, Ed, how would you respond to Melissa's question?
So, Melissa, I am by default, a bit of a cynic. I'm certainly not an optimist by nature, but I'm trying to find hope in the words and thoughts of a friend of mine named Rose Eveleth, who talks about imagining better futures. She writes and does a podcast about what the future might look like, and she notes that it behooves all of us to work hard to think about what the futures we want will look like, and then to work towards actually shaping them. We can't lose hope. We can't resign ourselves to thinking that all of these things are set in stone. Because if we don't make the effort to try and think about the world that we want and then move towards it, that world will never happen. So I'm trying in my pieces to say what a better outcome might look like, the steps that would need that we would need to take to get there. And I hope that at least by outlining those steps and providing a path forward, that I can at least convince some people to start walking towards it.
Well, Ed Yong is a science writer for The Atlantic. He has written beautifully and extensively about the COVID-19 pandemic. His latest piece is America's Patchwork Pandemic is Fraying Even Further. We have links to that at onpointradio.org. He's also author of the 2016 book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Ed, thank you for your work and your journalism, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, thank you for bringing in those listeners' questions.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.